Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
If it's Monday, new NBC News polling signals the midterms may have entered uncharted territory on the eve of another big primary night. Why November is shaping up to be unlike any other. Plus, new developments in the Mar-a-Lago legal drama as the deadline nears for the Department of Justice to file redactions to the key document justifying the unprecedented search of the former president's home. And later, the Biden administration sues to protect abortion access in Idaho as more states are set to enact near total bans on abortion this week. What today's court hearing means for the legal fight over abortion in post-Roe America. Welcome to Meet the Press Now. I'm Kristen Welker. Angry, anxious, and unpredictable. That pretty much sums up the state of the American electorate, according to our new NBC News poll, less than 80 days until the midterms and on the eve of another big night of primary elections. According to our poll, 74% of adults believe that the country is headed on the wrong track. It's the first time in the history of our poll that that number has been so high for so long. 58% say that Americans' best years are already behind us. That's another all-time high in our polling. And much of that voter frustration is looking for a political outlet. 61% say they are so fired up they would carry a protest sign for a day. And that includes 79% of Democrats and 48% of Republicans. It's a lopsided number that also gives you a sense of why Democrats have closed an all-important enthusiasm gap with the midterms now just 2.5 months away. In March, 67% of Republicans were highly interested in the midterm elections compared to 50% of Democrats. That split has now all but disappeared. In our August poll, about two-thirds of Republicans and also Democrats are expressing a high level of interest in November's elections. So what happened between March and now? Well, the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, and it has quite clearly energized Democrats for November. And now candidates across the country are seizing on the issue. Here's a new ad from Florida Democratic gubernatorial candidate Nikki Freed ahead of her primary tomorrow. Florida is just one place where voters will be voting tomorrow, with the marquee race being Freed facing off against former Governor Charlie Crist in the primary to take on incumbent Republican Governor Ron DeSantis. The other big state headed to the polls is New York, which features several key primaries, as well as a special election in a Hudson Valley swing district that will be closely watched as a potential midterm bellwether. And there's no surprise, the Democrat in the race, Pat Ryan, is putting abortion front and center. His Republican opponent, Mark Molinaro, is leaning hard into another big national issue, inflation. So to break it all down and to start us off, joining me now from Florida is NBC News correspondent Shaquille Brewster, and in New York, senior national political reporter Sahil Kapoor. You have both been all over these big races. Shaq, let me start with you. What are we learning in the home stretch about the Democratic Party's race to pick a candidate to take on Governor Ron DeSantis in November? This home stretch, what do the closing messages look like?
Well, you know, it's really interesting, Kristen, because in my conversations with both candidates, they've made very clear that their closing message and central to that closing message is Ron DeSantis. Each of them saying that they are the stronger candidate to go up against the incumbent Florida governor here. And you look at DeSantis, this will be a formidable challenge for Democrats come November. He is someone who's polling above 50% with his approval ratings. He has that national profile and has used that profile to store about $130 million in the bank to take on whichever Democrat comes out of the primary tomorrow. So for Charlie Crist, he's someone who's saying that he has electability and experience on his side. In my conversation, he said that he was someone who has won over Republican voters before, has won over moderate voters before, and that's why Democrats should choose him if they want to defeat DeSantis in November. This morning, we saw Nikki Fried here working the room a little bit with voters at a famous Cuban restaurant. Listen to what she said about her closing message.
We feel that the people of the Democratic Party here in the state of Florida understand that there are two things on everybody's minds. One is democracy, and two is unaffordability. And in order to make sure that both of those are winnable issues in November, the only person who can win this Democratic primary is myself. That we know that democracy is on this ballot, a women's right to choose is on this ballot, unaffordability.
You hear her mentioning the abortion issue. This is a state in Florida where there's been that 15-week abortion ban, where obviously women here are dealing with the overturning of Roe back in June. Charlie Crist doesn't dispute the idea that abortion will be a central issue for voters here, but he believes it's going to have more of an impact in November in that general election, Kristen.
And Shaq, Crist has really been on the defense on that issue. Of course, he's a former Republican governor. He's now a Democrat. So what specifically is he saying? And you know, Chuck's been pressing him on this in the interviews that he's done with Charlie Crist, his record on that very issue.
Yeah, and you hear Charlie Crist say that he is someone who has trusted. He's appointed judges before. He says he's someone that voters can trust. That is the line that he uses. But he acknowledges that some of his appointments that he made as governor, that he was disappointed by. And that's something that you heard Nikki Fried taking advantage of. The fact that you have a conservative Supreme Court justice locally here in Florida who Charlie Crist appointed. You hear her using the attack that he is someone who says he was pro-life. That's a phrase you see him repeating in campaign ads that Fried has blasted out on the airwaves here in Florida. But Crist says he defines pro-life in a different way, that he's always been someone who has protected abortion rights in the state of Florida, that one of his first actions as governor would be to codify Roe through executive action. So you're seeing that back and forth play out. We saw in polling, that national poll, you saw voters, Democratic voters, list abortion rights as one of their top issues. We'll see if that plays out once we get to November and if it has that pullover effect that both of these candidates think that it will have.
All right. And of course, Governor Ron DeSantis watching this very closely because he'll be facing off against the winner of tomorrow's primary in the fall. Sahil, I want to turn to you now, and I'm going to get to New York's Democratic primaries in just a second, but I do want to start with the special election in New York 19 to replace New York Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado. The reason why this is so closely watched, it pits a Democrat against a Republican, and it could have big implications for the fall, right? Talk a little bit about Pat Ryan and Mark Molinaro.
That's absolutely right, Kristen. One of the reasons this race is being so closely watched is that this has been a bellwether district that has so closely tracked the national mood. It was narrowly won by Joe Biden in 2020. It was narrowly won by Donald Trump in 2016. It was won by Barack Obama in 2012. Notice a trend here. It used to be a Republican district until Democrats flipped it in 2018 in the blue wave. And this special election will test a number of different cross currents ahead of the 2022 midterms and kind of give us a bit of a hint into the landscape for Republicans. Molinaro is running heavily on inflation and crime, running to try to make this a referendum on one-party Democratic rule in Washington, saying that needs to be shaken up. The Democrat, Pat Ryan, is running on a traditional slate of Democratic issues, including ending gun violence and getting money out of politics, but he is heavily emphasizing, as you point out, the Supreme Court's decision to overturn the constitutional right to an abortion as a way to galvanize Democratic voters to get them out. Democrats see that as potentially a black swan event ahead of the midterm election that could defy the historical trend where the party in power typically loses seats. This will be a test of whether Democrats are sufficiently motivated in that regard. Now, interestingly here, Kristen, both parties, operatives from both parties I talked to are downplaying their own chances. Both parties are worried about turnout for very different reasons. Democrats, because their base typically, you know, has a tendency to sleep through off-year elections, especially when their party is in power. Republicans are worried because this is coinciding with a New York primary, where they correctly note that Democrats tend to turn out in bigger numbers because independents can't participate, and there are just a lot more Democrats in this state. So both parties downplaying their own chances, but we will be able to tell quite a bit tomorrow when the results come in about how the midterm landscape is looking.
I'm glad you raised that. Sean Patrick Maloney, in an interview with Chuck on Meet the Press on Sunday, downplayed their chances in this critical race that they'll be watching very closely. Sahil, the other big race that everyone is watching in New York, of course, is against Maloney and Nadler. You have these two powerful Democrats, these two committee chairs. And if Democrats actually hold on to the House, they'll be losing one high-profile committee chair. What's the latest with this race?
And it's happening right here where I am in Midtown Manhattan, Kristen. This is a new blended district under the updated map that throws Carolyn Maloney and Jerry Nadler in the same district, pitting them against one another. Now, these are two members of the House who were first elected in 1992. They've served together for three decades. Nadler chairs the Judiciary Committee, Maloney chairs the Oversight Committee, and only one can win this primary. This has been quite a contentious fight that largely resulted from this earlier New York congressional map being thrown out and this new one being put in that has created a lot of tension, not just here, but in lower Manhattan, as well as a little further up in the Hudson Valley and Westchester County, Kristen.
Yeah, and that race has just gotten so much attention. It's so fascinating, both in Congress since 1992, the East versus the West side of New York. So we'll be watching it very closely. Sahil, thank you so much. And Shaq, thanks as well to you. Joining me now to discuss all of this is our panel, Josh Krasher, senior political correspondent at Axios, Simone Sanders Townsend, host of Simone on MSNBC and former advisor to Vice President Harris, and Rick Tyler, Republican strategist and an MSNBC political analyst. Let's start off by talking about this enthusiasm gap, which, according to our latest poll, has just narrowed considerably. Let's put the numbers up. I mean, it's within the margin of error, 68% to 66%. Josh, when you look at these numbers, what do you think is driving this? Is it purely Dobbs and Roe v. Wade being overturned, or what do you make of those numbers?
Abortion is the dominant issue. It's given Democrats, who are the party in power, usually doesn't get as excited for the first midterm election for their party. But clearly the Dobbs decision had a galvanizing effect. I also don't underestimate the impact of the Trump, the search, the fact that Trump is now the center of attention. We know in 2018, the last midterm election, when Trump is the center of attention, Democrats show up and are more engaged to go to the polls. So look, I think the Democratic base is turning out. I still think the NBC poll showed swing voters, still not sold on the Democratic Party, but it gets them one step closer to preventing the types of losses we were talking about a couple months ago.
Yeah, and I guess the question is, what does it actually look like, Simone, in these races? We saw in Kansas, and you and I have talked about this before, you saw that enthusiasm to get out and to vote for that Kansas ballot initiative. I mean, that was a single mm-hmm. issue that they were going out to vote for. It gets a lot more complicated when you're talking about a candidate who may have various different positions depending on what issue you're talking about. So how do you expect to see it play out in some of these races?
Look, I think the enthusiasm numbers are good. It means that Democratic voters are dialed in. It does not mean that Democratic voters are going to come out and vote. It means that they are susceptible to your message to come out and vote, and so you still have to turn them out. This is a turnout election. I do believe that abortion, obviously, motivating factor. I think guns. Folks are going back to school all over the country this month, mm-hmm. and parents are concerned. And we talk about Florida. In Florida specifically, Ron DeSantis, he endorsed 30 different local school board candidates. Okay, so schools are on the ballot this election cycle. I think it is going to be incumbent upon Democrats to continue to hone their message about what they have done, what that really means for people in places like what are the new energy numbers in this bill, Inflation Reduction Act law? What does that mean for Wisconsin? What do the prescription drugs provisions mean in Arizona? What can Mark Kelly say to Arizonans? And that is going to be the difference here.
Rick, what's the message for Republicans? Mark Molinaro, for example, trying to keep the focus on the economy, on inflation. Is that the right call? I mean, Josh brings up the point that you have the Mar-a-Lago search sort of looming large over all of this.
New York 19 is emblematic of the entire race, which is why everybody's paying attention to it, because the number one concern that Democrats have is actually abortion is second. So it is a motivating factor, but number one is democracy. And what the Republicans have done is they've turned a classic Biden down in the polls, inflation is high, lots of challenges. Democrats normally typically don't turn out in off-year elections as much as Republicans do. They had all that in their sails. And what they've done is they have nominated Trump candidates. And so this is turning into, instead of what the Republicans wanted, which is a referendum against Biden and his administration, his performance, although he's been fairly successful lately, it is now going to be a referendum on Trump. That is a remarkable turn of events. Considered, my hat's off to the Democrats who maneuvered the Republicans from back to blue to defund the Gestapo. I mean, this is a remarkable, just giving up the crime issue entirely.
And, you know, you raise that point, and it's notable because you do have Republicans who had kind of left Trump, and now the Mar-a-Lago search, it seems to be galvanizing Republicans around Trump in this moment. And I wonder if that's making the Republican Party jittery. Establishment Republicans.
Well, it should make them jittery because not only is Trump seeing record fundraising, they're seeing people supporting him. There's a whole number of reasons for that, but 57% still want these investigations to go on. Mm-hmm. But I think the Republican establishment, of course, does not want Trump to be the center of attention in this election. They want Biden to be the center of attention because his numbers are still in the 40s. And if Trump becomes the center of attention, and if he announces, God forbid, for the Republicans this fall, every Republican trying to win a race will be asked every morning by every reporter in the country, what do you think about the nonsensical thing that Donald Trump said this morning?
But he doesn't even need to run because his candidates are on the ballot. And you're reminded of Trump every day you hear a Blake Masters or a Dr. Oz or a Herschel Walker talk. And that is the big problem. The NBC poll has Biden's job approval at 42%. The Republicans have a 2-point advantage on the generic ballot. Right track, wrong track, really. You know, Kristen, you said how bad it is for the party in power. It's the candidates. It's these MAGA candidates that are really jeopardizing Republican prospects.
You know, and Rick, you brought up something interesting, which is that President Biden now believes he's had some legislative wins. He wants to go out. He wants to talk about them. Chuck was talking to Representative Andy Barr yesterday and pressed him, you know, what are your policy proposals to deal with inflation? And he didn't really have a specific answer. He kind of continued along that track of countering President Biden. Do you think that's smart politics, or should Republicans get an answer to that question?
Well, the last time Republicans tried to put up policy alternatives in Rick Scott's proposal, it caused them some political problems.
Biden seized on it. He made it one of his core arguments.
Absolutely. I think, though, when you're talking about the dominant issue in the campaign, rising cost of prices, goods, the economy, it would help for someone like Andy Barr or anyone in the Republican rank and file to have an answer on what you would do differently, what the Republican alternative would be.
Yeah. Simone, the Democrats, again, they do have some things to tout, and we are going to see that from President Biden once he's off of his vacation. And yet you have inflation, which continues to be high, continues to be intractable. If you look at the polling, the economy is still one of the big issue for voters.
Oh, the economy is absolutely the big issue. I would argue, frankly, that abortion is an economic issue. The ability of women to make decisions about their lives, work, community, family, directly tied to their pockets. I think that Democrats should go out there and make the point that not only is this what the bill is going to do for you, but Republicans want to talk about inflation. Every single one of them in the United States Congress voted against the Inflation Reduction Act. We don't know why. Maybe someone should ask them. I do think that, look, you live by the gas prices, you die by the gas prices, right? It's kind of like living by the stock market. Gas prices are going down. There is a concern that gas prices could go back up. And so I think that the White House is right to continue to tout the good things that are happening, what they have done to get these numbers down. But caution, 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 caution. Things could go up.
Rick, do you think that Republicans should start getting an answer to that question, what they get specific about what their policy proposals would be? Or is it enough to just say, look, this is happening on Biden's
part
watch?
Part of what the Democrats have an advantage because their answer is always a big government solution. And then, of course, that's easy to report on. It's not easy to report on free market solutions because they don't involve government, right? So there isn't. advantage there. Look, from a purely political perspective, the Inflation Reduction Act, which I think is a misnomer because it does nothing, in my opinion, to reduce inflation, it doesn't matter. The Democrats like it. They think it is going to reduce inflation. It was a big boost for them, and the Republicans don't, again, they didn't have an answer for it. There is no one on my side who knows how to, that I know of, who knows how to defend free market economics in the way Milton Friedman could.
Were you all surprised to see that concerns about the democracy has now moved to the top issue in our polling? Do you think that helps Democrats? What do you make of that?
I think it helps Democrats, but I also think, one, I know it's the way that the question was asked, and so I think we'll have to see how it how this tracks between now and November if democracy still stays the number one concern. But also I think it speaks to the fact that the January 6th hearings could have been impactful. This was during the same time that the search on Mar-a-Lago happened. People are like, what is happening? Meanwhile, you got election deniers running, and you're hearing about it. I don't know what this means specifically for this November. Again, folks are going out and they're not voting on ballot initiatives. They're voting on particular people, particular candidates. And unless people do their research, maybe they don't know that, you know, Tudor Dixon isn't on the up and up in Michigan.
All right. Well, a lot to chew on. Thank you so much for getting us started on a very busy Monday. Really appreciate it, Simone, Rick, and Josh. Great conversation. And we are following some breaking news out of Atlanta that we want to tell you about now, where authorities are searching for an unknown female gunman. At least one person has died. Another has been shot and taken to the hospital after a gunman opened fire in Midtown Atlanta. In a statement on Twitter, Atlanta police said multiple officers responded to the scene and are still searching the area for the suspect. This is an active situation, and we will bring you more as we learn it. And coming up next, we're going to have live coverage of tomorrow night's election results, including those key New York and Florida races we were just talking about, on our Meet the Press election special at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on NBC News Now. And coming up, the latest on the legal saga over the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago and why a Florida judge says releasing a key court document at the center of a major legal fight could be, quote, meaningless. That's next. Plus, Russia blaming Ukraine for a car bombing that killed the daughter of a Putin ally as the war in Ukraine approaches its sixth-month mark. You're watching Meet the Press Now. Stay with us.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
You can start your day off right when you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome back. We are awaiting a judge's decision on what the public will and will not see from the Justice Department's affidavit justifying its search of Mar-a-Lago. Judge Bruce Reinhart has formally given DOJ until Thursday to propose what parts of the document should be redacted. And there could be a lot of blacked out material, because in a written order today, the judge indicated that he may not unseal much, if anything, from the affidavit. Former President Trump and his allies have demanded the affidavit be unsealed. Several media outlets, including NBC News, have also requested access to it. The Justice Department, though, argues that releasing it could cause irreparable damage to an ongoing criminal investigation. It comes as our NBC News poll reveals that a majority of voters, 57%, we were just talking about this, say investigations into the former president should continue. Ryan Riley covers the Justice Department for NBC News and joins me now. Ryan, thanks so much for joining me. Really appreciate it. So I want to read you part of what Judge Reinhart wrote today and then get your reaction on the other side. The judge wrote, quote, "I cannot say at this point that partial redactions will be so extensive that they will result in a meaningless disclosure, but I may ultimately reach that conclusion after hearing further from the government." So based on today's order, what are you expecting to see in the affidavit, if anything?
If we ultimately see it, I think we're going to be looking at a lot of black ink, essentially, on those papers when we get them or when we print them out, because I think that the redactions are going to be pretty heavy from the Justice Department here. Essentially, what the judge said last week is that he wasn't sure it was proper for DOJ or for him to be making the decision on whether or not what would be able to be disclosed after the redactions was meaningful or not. So basically saying that if the news organizations wanted something, even if it was just a little bit of information and this was a heavily redacted document, it wasn't up to them to make that sort of editorial decision on whether or not that would advance any reporting on where exactly this investigation is headed.
So basically, the judge has given the Justice Department until Thursday to submit its proposals, what it thinks should be redacted. How long do you expect the judge to review that proposed version of the affidavit?
I would say this is pretty high up on his priority list, just given the seriousness of this investigation. And, you know, if you look back at this, it's been a very speedy process. It's only been 2 weeks since the compound was actually searched here, right? We're just hitting the 2 week mark now, and already we've gone through several rounds back and forth about this. Although I would note that even in those 2 weeks, even though there's been some discussion about it, Donald Trump's team has not yet filed that motion for a so-called special master, sort of an outside person who would be appointed to look at what exactly was seized and sort of sort through that. Right now, the FBI is the one sort of in charge of doing that sorting and decide whether or not there's anything that needs to be returned to the former president, whether there's anything that needs to be excluded from an investigation, and what exactly can be folded into the investigation overall. But, you know, I think just if you step back more broadly, the fact is here is that the president seemed to have a lot of materials that he wasn't supposed to possess, regardless of their classification level. Those documents that were generated as part of his presidential administration were not his to keep. They were not his personal documents, regardless of his personal beliefs that appear to be directly in opposition to the law.
Yeah, I think it's an important point that you raise, that regardless of whether the documents were classified or declassified, it really doesn't get to the heart of the potential charges or concerns that they have about the fact that he was holding them. Thank you so much, Ryan Riley. I really appreciate it. We do want to bring you an update now in the news we brought you a few moments ago from that Midtown Atlanta shooting where at least one person has been killed and another has been hospitalized. Atlanta police now say the suspect is in custody, and you see the scene there, very active in downtown Atlanta. We will continue to track all of the developments related to this developing story and bring them to you as we get them. Coming up next, Ukraine braces for an escalation in Russian attacks after a car bomb killed the daughter of a key Putin ally. We have a live report from Ukraine next. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. The 29-year-old daughter of Russian ultra-nationalist Alexander Dugin, also known as Putin's brain, was killed in a car explosion near Moscow over the weekend, according to Russia's investigative committee. Russia's FSB is claiming they have solved her murder, and they're blaming Ukrainian intelligence for planting the explosive underneath the driver's side of the car. Now, Russian authorities say they believe her father was the intended target of the attack. NBC News has not been able to independently verify this information. Kyiv, however, is denying any involvement with the incident. An advisor to President Zelensky saying yesterday, quote, "We are not a criminal state like Russia." But the bombing is prompting new fears of Russian escalation as Ukraine prepares to mark both the six-month anniversary of the war and its Independence Day on Wednesday. President Zelensky is warning that Russia may do something particularly cruel ahead of their national day. I'm joined now by Josh Letterman, who is in Ukraine covering all of this for us. Josh, thank you for joining us on this Monday. So what has the reaction been in Ukraine to the car bombing incident? What's the latest? Are there concerns about retaliation?
There are absolutely those exact concerns, Kristen, and the reaction really has been fear that even as tensions are so high here already, with everything going on with the nuclear power plant crisis here, fears of Russia using the occasion of Ukraine's Independence Day on Wednesday to mount even more cruel attacks, as Zelensky said, that this could just be the latest pretext, justification that Russia could use to launch more vicious and more punishing attacks on Ukraine. And in fact, that has been the reaction from many corners already in Moscow. We heard from Alexander Dugin, the father of this young woman who was killed in this car bomb, saying today that there should be vengeance on Ukraine, coming out almost immediately after the FSB accused Ukraine's special forces of being behind this attack in Moscow, saying that this is just the latest example of why Russia needs to win this war here. And so this has really galvanized the right wing in Russia in ways that are really causing concerns here in Ukraine, as they, as you point out, completely deny that they have anything to do with this. They say it's a bogus allegation. And they also say that what Ukraine's government thinks is actually happening here, Kristen, is a power competition amongst Russia's intelligence services. They think essentially this is the various powers in Russia starting to line up their various factions ahead of anticipating the day when President Putin may not be in power anymore and there may be a power vacuum to fill. So that is the spy novel Cold War intrigue that is really taking place as Ukrainians hope for the best heading into this very pivotal week.
Well, and it is a pivotal week, and it's so extraordinary to think that it has been 6 months. What is the mood there on the ground as they prepare to mark these two very monumental anniversaries?
I would say it's one of defiance. We saw Ukrainians parading burnt out military tanks from Russia through the streets of Kyiv this week, essentially thumbing their nose at President Putin, who thought he was going to be able to march into Ukraine, take over the capital in something like 3 days, was not able to do that. You don't hear any Ukrainians at this point thinking that they are going to lose this war. But the big concern here, Kristen, is that this becomes a frozen conflict heading into the winter and that there are many more months of fighting ahead. And that could mean many more Ukrainians who are going to lose their lives along the way.
It's just a tragic situation. Josh, thank you so much for being there, and please continue to stay safe. We really appreciate it. Now I want to bring in Ann Applebaum, staff writer at The Atlantic. Ann, good to see you. Thank you so much for joining us. Give us the broad sense here as we continue to track this part of the ongoing conflict there. Who is Alexander Dugin? Why is he so important to Putin? And why is it so extraordinary that his daughter was killed?
Alexander Dugin is somebody whose role is probably overestimated in the West. He's somebody who's made a lot of noise in the West. He's one of the Russians who has been most actively in contact with the European and the American far right. He seeks to present himself as a Russian nationalist and as a leader of the nationalists around the world, and especially in Europe. And he's presented himself as close to Putin. It's not clear that that's really true, but certainly he's a symbol of the nationalist camp. He supported the war in Ukraine. And most importantly, he supports the genocidal language that's used about Ukraine. You know, the idea that Ukraine's not a real state, it's not a real country, and it can be destroyed. Therefore, there are actually a lot of different kinds of people who might have been interested in killing him. I mean, the Russian state has accused the Ukrainians. Actually, a Russian group has taken responsibility, something calling itself the National Republican Army, describing itself as a violent Russian opposition movement, says they've done it. They have a representative in Kiev, somebody speaking for them in Kiev, who's a former Russian MP, who says they're responsible. But as you heard already, there's also a lot of thought that it could be somebody in the Russian secret services. It could be someone among the Russian oligarchs. There are a lot of people who don't like the war, or who don't like the nationalist group, or who might have wanted him and his daughter, who was incidentally also a nationalist propagandist, who might have wanted them both out of the way.
And of course, as Josh was reporting, as we've been reporting, Russia is blaming Kyiv. They say that's absolutely not the case. You just laid out all of the reasons why it very well could be someone inside Russia. But is anyone giving that credence? Are our intelligence officials in the United States, for example, giving that possibility any credence?
So I think it's a little early for anyone to say what has credence, given that there's been no evidence presented of any kind. All we really know is what the Russian authorities have told us, and they're not a reliable source. I mean, the idea that it was the Ukrainians would imply that the Ukrainian secret services are far more sophisticated than anyone imagined, that they have a whole network inside Moscow, that they can reach deep inside the Moscow elite and set off a car bomb. If that's true, it's rather amazing. And I think that's why people are doubting that. And, you know, there's also, it's maybe important for your listeners to know, there's a long tradition in Russian history of murders like this one being used for other purposes. Mm. There's a famously Stalin murdered one of his opponents and then used that as an excuse to launch the Great Purge of 1937 and 1938. So there's a tradition of using an event like this as an excuse for other things. And I think that's the historical tradition people are looking to.
And just big picture, we are approaching 6 months into this war now. There initially had been some hope that the two sides could come together and try to broker some type of peace deal. At this point in time, that seems like a far-off possibility. What are your expectations about how long this might last? Do you see any signs that they could come back to the table and try to broker some type of way out of this conflict?
The only way there will be permanent peace in Ukraine is if the Ukrainians win. And by winning, I mean at least they eject the Russians from the territory that they've occupied since February. Because only then will the Russians have concluded that they can't conquer Ukraine, that there's no point in simply stopping and waiting, which is what they did in 2014, and, you know, regathering their forces and trying again. So there has to be the reason there hasn't been a negotiation is that the Ukrainians still think they can win. Many of their Western backers, at least some of them, think they can win. And frankly, the Russians are certainly, you know, there is a kind of stalemate right now. The Russians are no longer moving forward. The Ukrainians are beginning to strike far behind the lines, including even today and yesterday in Crimea. And there's a sense in Ukraine that the war might be turning. And while that possibility is still there, I don't think there is any incentive for either side to negotiate just yet.
Well, Anne Applebaum, we so appreciate your insights. Anne is a journalist and expert in the history of Russia and the Soviet Union. Thank you so much for joining us on this Monday. We really appreciate it. After the break, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has been sending thousands of migrants to places like New York City and Washington, D.C., and now mayors are asking the federal government to step in. You're watching Meet the Press Now. Welcome back. As in most election years, immigration is a key issue. 13% of voters say it's the most important issue facing this country, according to our new NBC News poll. And one political battle over the border is now playing out hundreds of miles away from it, in New York City and Washington, D.C., where Texas Governor Greg Abbott and Arizona Governor Doug Ducey are sending busloads of migrants. Now those cities' mayors are asking the federal government for help. NBC News national correspondent Gabe Gutierrez takes a closer look.
The buses keep coming to New York City and Washington, D.C. At first, hundreds, now thousands of migrants arriving in the Northeast after being sent by the governors of Texas and Arizona.
The need has outstripped our capacity to respond to it.
Calling it a humanitarian crisis, D.C.'s mayor has requested the National Guard. New York City's mayor is also asking the federal government for help.
I don't think anything is more anti-American than shipping people on a bus 45-hour trip without any of the basic needs that they have, a direction or coordination.
Democrats call the busing a political stunt. Republicans argue it's a last resort as scenes like this unfold at the U.S. southern border. Large groups of migrants crossing, human smugglers cramming 150 people into this 18-wheeler. The Border Patrol says more than 200 dead migrants have been found in just one section of Texas since last October. Nationwide, border apprehensions actually fell 4% from June to July, but overall, this fiscal year has seen the highest number on record.
It was just Texas and Arizona that bore the brunt of all of the chaos and all the problems that come with it. Now the rest of America is understanding exactly what is going on.
We recently visited Catholic Charities in New York City.
Have you ever seen numbers like this?
Not really.
Which has been scrambling to help the growing number of migrants, many from Venezuela, who captured the grueling journey on their cell phones.
Do you think you'd survive? Pensaste que iba a sobrevivir?
We spoke with Ruben from Colombia, who told us his four children thought they were going to die. When we finally reached U.S. soil, he says, I thank God for giving me the strength.
Gabe, what an incredible report there. And Gabe joins me now. So what are some of the other things that New York plans to do to handle this influx?
Well, Kristen, as you said, the city has seen more than 6,000 migrants bust here so far, and it is straining the resources also of the education system. Local authorities say that they plan to enroll more than 1,000 children before the school year starts next month. And among the things being discussed is potentially recruiting more bilingual teachers, potentially from the Dominican Republic, to help with some of this here. And local authorities have also set up, you know, a triage center for some of the buses that are arriving at Port Authority here in New York City. Again, the mayor says that the resources are stretched thin, Kristen.
Well, and you certainly showed that in your piece there. Gabe Gutierrez, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. And before we go to break, the man who became the face of the federal response to the pandemic is now stepping down. Dr. Anthony Fauci announced today that he'll be leaving as director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, as well as chief medical advisor to President Biden. His departure will come in December. Dr. Fauci, though, says he's not retiring and will continue working in another capacity, but he has not yet announced what that will be. Dr. Fauci had previously said he planned to leave the federal government by the end of President Biden's first term. During his career, he's advised seven different U.S. presidents over four decades on several public health crises, including HIV/AIDS and the Ebola virus, and of course, now COVID-19. Still to come, the Biden administration's last-ditch effort to protect abortion access in Idaho as a near-total ban is set to take effect. You're watching Meet the Press Now. We're back after a quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back. A federal judge in Idaho heard the first arguments today in the Justice Department's lawsuit over Idaho's near total ban on abortion, which is slated to go into effect Thursday. The Biden administration is trying to get the law temporarily halted while larger legal proceedings play out. The judge said he would hand down a ruling by Wednesday, but seemed to suggest that he would potentially rule in the government's favor. Idaho's ban would make it illegal to perform nearly any abortion, with narrow exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. The DOJ sued the state over that last exception earlier this month, arguing that the ban's narrow criteria violates a federal law requiring doctors to offer emergency medical treatment. It's the department's first litigation on reproductive rights after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade earlier this summer. In the NBC News poll released this weekend, a majority of voters, 58%, said they disapprove of the court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. Joining me now to discuss this, NBC News justice correspondent Ken Delanian, who's been following the developments in this lawsuit. Ken, thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it. So what did we hear today from the Justice Department? This is their first time arguing one of these cases.
So this is really a case about the supremacy clause in the Constitution, not about abortion rights. It's about the notion that federal law trumps state law. And what the Justice Department is saying is that there's this federal law that requires hospitals to provide necessary emergency services. And in some cases, that could include an abortion if a pregnant woman who has her life is threatened in a pregnancy complication. And so the Justice Department is saying that this state law that bans almost all abortions conflicts with that federal law. The states and a number of red states have weighed in on Idaho's side, have said no, they don't think that's true. In fact, they think that if the Biden administration succeeds here, it's going to redefine the relationship between the states and the United States. But the judge, as you said, seemed to side with the Biden administration, saying, look, this law essentially provides a defense for doctors, but they have to go to trial. It allows any prosecutor to bring a doctor up on criminal charges and then force the doctor to essentially prove that the life of the mother was in danger.
And the judge has said that he will hand down a decision by Wednesday. Given what we heard, given what you just mapped out, what specifically are you expecting? Is there a middle ground that the judge could find?
So the Justice Department is asking for two things. One, for him to essentially halt the implementation of the law, which would go into effect Thursday. And second, that he rule that in fact this law is unconstitutional. It almost doesn't matter what he rules because it's going to be appealed. This case is going to go up, and it could go up as high as the Supreme Court. But it will be interesting to see whether he grants that temporary injunction. He seems to be inclined to do that.
20 other states and organizations have filed amicus briefs. What does that tell you about this?
So on the one hand, you have all these red states, right? And then on the other hand, you have all these doctor groups, some of the most prominent medical groups in the country, saying it just shows you how divided we are. But it also shows that the medical community believes that in certain cases, abortion is health care. And in these cases, they are saying, look, you can't ask doctors to decide how many pints of blood a woman has to lose before we decide when to intervene. We just have to be free to do that and not worry about being prosecuted.
Yeah, it really puts the onus on the practitioners. Ken Delaney, and thank you so much. It's incredibly complicated. We'll continue to follow it. Really appreciate it. And good to see you.
You too.
Turning now to Mark Herron, senior counsel for the Center for Reproductive Rights. He argued against a similar Texas abortion law, Whole Women's Health versus Jackson, in front of the Supreme Court just last year. Mark, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. So you heard Ken really map out the states here, the DOJ arguing the law violates access to federally guaranteed emergency medical care, basically putting the burden on doctors to prove that an abortion was necessary to save a woman's life. What did you make of the Justice Department's argument today? How compelling was it?
All right, well, thanks for having me. You know, it's remarkable that states like Idaho are defending laws that are creating medical crisis for patients across the country, and it's a growing medical crisis. I mean, imagine that you are a patient with a pregnancy that you wanted, that you're excited about, and then at 17, 18, 19 weeks pregnant, your water breaks and you begin to suffer the trauma of a miscarriage. And you go to the emergency room where you would expect to receive medical treatment. And in fact, federal law guarantees that you'll get federal treatment, the law that the Justice Department is suing under. And the doctor walks in and says, I'm sorry, but you're not sick enough. Your fetus has ongoing cardiac activity, so there's nothing we can do. You're not bleeding enough. You may be bleeding. You may have an ongoing infection, but because your vital signs are stable enough, you're not sick enough to qualify for the health care that we can provide you. And so instead, all you can do is sit and wait. And we've seen patients who have tried to get on airplanes after their water has already broken, because they need healthcare, and states are banning the provision of that healthcare, whether it's in Idaho or Texas, because of the confusion over these medical emergency exceptions that are written so narrowly that doctors can't rely on them to provide the care that they know works. People are waking up to the realization that abortion is healthcare.
Yeah.
And that it is vital. And this is a man-made crisis that is only going to grow.
And you've talked about the implications for a woman. Talk about what this would mean to doctors, to healthcare providers, the burden, the onus on them to prove that a woman's life was at risk. I mean, how would that even work?
Right. So in the Idaho case, a doctor who provides an abortion could be criminally charged and then would have to prove at trial that, well, I think the patient was bleeding enough, or the fever was high enough, or the risk to the patient's health was strong enough. And they would have to prove that in a criminal trial where their livelihood is at stake, their ability to practice medicine is at stake because their license, medical license could be taken away. What rational doctor would provide healthcare to their patients? But these are patients who need care. And look, this is only going to grow. We now, at the end of this week, we may have 11 states that have total bans on abortion and that have these confusing medical emergency exceptions.
Well, so yeah, and Mark, you take me to my next question, which is that we expect Tennessee and Texas to basically implement similar laws that are going to go into effect the same day as Idaho. So do you expect, and should the Justice Department take actions in those states as well?
Well, we certainly need governments at every level, government institutions, to step in and protect patients. We need Congress to act and pass a national law, the Women's Health Protection Act, that would ensure the right to abortion. We need state attorneys general. We need state courts to recognize the right to abortion in the state constitutions. Now is the time, during this growing medical crisis that is man-made, that is made by governments, for governments to respond and begin to protect patients.
And Mark, I wonder if you can help us understand, because the Justice Department is really arguing a narrow piece of the law. Do you think that the Justice Department needs to expand what it's arguing, or is this smart legal strategy?
Well, look, the strategy that the Justice Department is taking right now is focusing on this current federal law, which does protect the right of patients to get medical treatment when they present at an emergency room, and they need medical treatment, right? And so the Justice Department is doing the right thing by focusing on that current federal law. I think that, you know, as these cases progress and state by state, there will be opportunities for all sorts of lawyers. I mean, the legal profession is stepping up to protect patients and to try to establish the right, under state constitutions. I work at the Center for Reproductive Rights. We've been litigating across the United States, including in Texas and Louisiana, to try to preserve abortion access. And, I think that the Justice Department will continue to do so as well.
Okay. Mark Herron, thank you so much. And the stakes, obviously, incredibly high for the Justice Department. It's the first time, again, that they are arguing one of these cases. We really appreciate your insights and for joining us to help us understand this really complicated case. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. And thank you for joining us. I will be back tomorrow with more Meet the Press Now. And don't miss our special coverage of tomorrow night's primary elections. We'll have results in three states starting at 9 p.m. Eastern. NBC News Now coverage continues with Hallie Jackson right now.
You can start your day off right when you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.